Nexus PMG welcomes you to the Bigger Than Us podcast, which we as energy geeks lovingly refer to as the BTU. Bigger Than Us is a podcast that focuses on ideas that will shape the future of our planet and ultimately our existence. We will occasionally lean into energy topics because, after all, it's the key to our collective survival, but we'll also explore other ideas and topics that we believe will have an impact that is bigger than us. And now, on to today's show. Hello and welcome to the Bigger Than Us podcast. I'm your host, Raj Daniels, and today I'd like to welcome Seth Godin to the show. Seth Godin is an entrepreneur, best-selling author, speaker, teacher, and the founder of the Carbon Almanac. In addition to launching one of the most popular blogs in the world, he has written 21 best-selling books, including The Dip, Linchpin, Purple Cow, Tribes, and What to Do When It's Your Turn. And it's always your turn. Seth, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Raj. Thanks for doing this work. And just the name of the podcast alone is just so important. It needs to be done. Thank you.
Seth, thank you. And before we dig into the Carbon Almanac, I want to share some things in public here. I've been following your work for about 9 or 10 years. In 2016, you released a book, It's Your Turn. I took that to heart. I started blogging, wrote over 1,000 blog posts. 2017, December, I published a book. And in the foreword to the book, I wrote about you and thanked you for your work.
Wow.
So I feel like this conversation has been 8 years in the making.
I'm honored. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Now, I mentioned the Carbon Almanac. Tell me, what inspired you to bring this book together? And I'm saying specifically, bring the book together and not writing it, because there's a reason for that.
Right. So 16 years ago, I wrote my first blog post about climate change. Maybe it was 12. And clearly that wasn't sufficient to solve the problem. But I found myself not talking about it very much because I felt stupid. I felt uninformed. Then I read a book by Kim Stanley Robinson called Ministry for the Future. And it punched me really hard. And I realized that if I felt uninformed, other people did too. And in fact, it was probably willful indoctrination on the part of extraction industries to make us feel like we shouldn't talk about it. Well, to some people, they have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. To me, I'm an educator and lots of things look like a book. And I used to be a book packager, and I've done almanacs, more almanacs than any living human, actually. The thought was that friendly, browsable, shareable format could really help educate a lot of people. But I also knew that if I did it myself, I wouldn't be modeling the only way forward. And the only way forward is for individuals to come together. The only way forward is through peer-to-peer organization. So I invited probably a dozen people to join me, and then another circle and another circle. We ended up with 400 volunteers, and in the end, 1,900 volunteers. I worked on it full-time as a volunteer for a year and a half. But we built a 97,000-word illustrated, fact-checked, documented, footnoted almanac in 5 months with no significant errors. And it has gone on to be published around the world and win design awards and make a difference. And I would do it again in a heartbeat. I'm really pleased at the output. And I'm also thrilled at the people I got to work with. They are friends for the rest of my life.
Let's go back to this feeling of feeling uninformed. You said it was 15 or 16 years between feeling uninformed and then finally being inspired to bring people together to write the book. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've all had a lot on our minds. A worldwide pandemic will do that. What we do when we feel like there aren't very many people who think they can do anything about gravity. So we don't spend a lot of time talking about gravity because it feels like we're powerless. And what we have come to be taught is that there's nothing we can do about the climate, that the climate isn't that bad, that we're going to be fine, that technology is going to save the day, or most of all, that it's complicated, that It involves math and science and probability, and a lot of people just roll their eyes when they encounter something complicated and they look the other way. And the same thing's true with 401k plans. The same thing's true with our diets. We just make bad short-term decisions because we feel overwhelmed, and it's subtle. We don't sit there feeling bad about feeling overwhelmed. We just avert our gaze.
Now, you also mentioned the idea that corporations intentionally want to make us feel like stupid or we can't do anything about it. How do we start unwinding that?
Okay, well, you know, everyone does what they think is right and what is on their agenda in every given moment. And what is on the agenda of an extraction company that has $1 trillion worth of stuff underground is to not have it disappear tomorrow, because that would harm their career, their families, and lots of their short-term interests. So other than a few people who deliberately set out to mislead us at Exxon a long time ago, I don't think most people in industry are setting out to be bad people. I do think that we tend to follow the incentives. And if you are surrounded by people whose income goes up when the stock goes up and whose income goes down when the stock goes down, that groupthink is going to kick in. And so what we see here, for example, is the laws of physics cannot be suspended and almost all plastic cannot be recycled. It just cannot be recycled at any cost. But much plastic recycling that is possible is too expensive. But the plastics industry invented the meme of plastic recycling before it was even possible at all. And now we've got these blue boxes everywhere we look. In my county, which is one of the wealthiest counties in America, if you put your plastic bottle in that bin, they're going to pick it up and burn it. And when I help people see this, it does not make them happy, because they've been indoctrinated into thinking that good people recycle plastic. I throw all my plastic in the trash because I want to feel terrible when I buy plastic. But even people who understand what's going to happen still put their plastic in the bin because the social cost of not doing it is.
You know, I heard you say on another interview that unfortunately, well, you didn't say unfortunately, you said, but to some extent, we're all hypocrites on this journey. Now, what I've tried to do with the show and guests on this show is ask questions around what would be a reasonable transition. Because while you're correct about the harm to the environment, there has been a lot of good, and I use that in quotation, that's come from the fossil fuel industries across the board. What I found in interviewing and talking to people is that many times people are trying to draw hard and fast lines in the sand and demonize each other for their agendas. And what I try to explain to them is, look, there's a lot of brain power, intellect in that industry that can help us during the transition. But if you come across hard and fast and pointing fingers, which I think to some extent there are groups of people that enjoy doing that because divisiveness always works, or works frequently, nothing's going to get done. Everyone's going to dig their heels in for their own interests. So,
sure.
You know, I have the Art Carbon Almanac here, and you detailed, or the team detailed, some phenomenal technologies. But how do we cross that bridge, if you will, where the lines are drawn in the sand?
Okay, so I'm super glad you brought this up. I have tried, and the team has tried, to not demonize anyone in the book and in our conversation here. What I am trying to outline is this. Extraction fossil fuels made us all rich. Every person on the planet is richer because we had a 110-year free ride of taking something that took millions of years to build and burning it. And it creates an enormous amount of short-term value. There is no doubt about it. Just like if you're hungry, eating the seed corn that you've set aside for next year's harvest will make you full. The problem is when next year rolls around, you don't have anything left to plant. And so we have a transition challenge. And the challenge is there are billions and billions of people on this earth who are hooked on the benefits of cheap energy. And the status quo is the status quo because it's good at sticking around. And what we know, without any room for debate, is that some of the elements of the status quo are dramatically hurting our unborn grandchildren and probably us in just 10 years, that we're going to see millions and millions of climate refugees showing up every single year. So what to do about it? Well, we already know what to do about it. We do it with almost everything else, which is when you charge a fair price for something, the correct price for something, people make good decisions. What does that mean? It means that if at the high school cafeteria, you subsidize the price of ice cream sandwiches and they're only a penny, people are going to eat a lot of ice cream sandwiches because they're only a penny. When we charge the correct price for something, people can calculate whether they think it's worth it or not. And the correct price for a gallon of gas is not $4. And the correct price for a carefully packaged yoga brick from Amazon is not a nickel. But that is what is being charged for it right now. And what we know about free markets is that free markets depend on the accurate price of the things that we make choices about. And what we've done is we've artificially subsidized the price of fossil fuels. So we don't have to demonize everybody. What we have to do is start on a path to charge the right price. And the way we do that, I believe, this is me talking, not the Almanac team, is very simple, easily demonstrated, and not hard to begin. And what we do is we give every single person, every citizen, first in a country, then around the planet, a check every single year based on how much we collect when we charge the right price for fossil fuels. So you can make a choice. When it costs $400,000 to fly a private jet from New York to London, you could either pay the $400,000 or enjoy getting the rebate checks from the other people who pay the $400,000. But by charging the right price and not using that money to fund any government projects, but simply give it back to people who don't want to pay the premium for something, we can do this gradually and the community will shift. And the reason it will shift is because all of these new technologies that are coming along, all of these alternatives will suddenly become economically more feasible, race down the experience curve, and become cheaper.
So race down the experience curve. I've had a lot of conversations both on the show and privately with people in the environmental justice sector. And there are a lot of people out there that are going to hurt during this transition. To some extent, people are calling it, especially since the Inflation Reduction Act, some of it might be even looked at as a regressive tax. And you know, you mentioned about eating the seed corn and not being able to look forward. There's a great book I read years ago called Scarcity, and it talks about, you know, what people are thinking about around the dining table, people that are working 2-3 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
How do we help those people along the transition? Because, you know, I'm fortunate, live in the suburbs, it's nice, you know, we get EV chargers and garages, but the people that perhaps are going to get left behind, how would you perhaps suggest accelerating this program that you're talking, again, that you're talking about and not the team?
Okay, so from what I understand about the carbon pricing and border adjustment, the data I have seen show that the people who have the least privilege will benefit the most during the transition, not the other way around. It's not regressive. And the reason it's not is simple, because everybody is getting this check, this dividend that comes from people using carbon. The people who are using the most carbon by a factor of 1,000 are rich people, which means that rich people will pay, and they always do, for the things they want to pay for. The side effect of that, instead of simply flooding Bangladesh, will be that a check gets handed to somebody who has no choice but to keep driving a 1968 Honda Civic, because that will decrease what they have to pay for gas. But when it's then time for them to make a new decision, they're going to say, wait a second, I got to get a new vehicle, a replacement vehicle sooner or later. Anyway, this electric bike is going to be so much cheaper because of this regime that I'm going to come out even further ahead. So I'm not proposing, though that's a whole other conversation, whether we should think much harder about how we become progressive with the distribution of wealth, the Gini index, and all that other stuff. What I am saying is the emergency in front of us is simple. We are artificially lowering the price of fossil fuels at the peril of everybody who only has one planet to live on, which is all of us. And every day we wait makes it worse. So let's go ahead right this minute and gradually start charging the right price for carbon.
So would you propose doing that for agriculture too?
Oh yeah. Everything that, you know, 24% of all of the climate change that we are causing this year will be caused by beef and milk. So if you want to have a hamburger, go ahead and have a hamburger, but it shouldn't cost you what it's costing you now, because I am not eating a hamburger and I am paying for your hamburger. And I would imagine that if you offered somebody a tasty alternative to a hamburger for 1/8 the price, they would say, thank you, I appreciate having that option. But right now, if you're looking for something to eat that's inexpensive and filling, a hamburger is cheap. And the reason it's cheap is because all of us are subsidizing the price of it.
Let's say we had a magic wand and were able to do something along these lines. Would you perhaps recommend a new arm of the government, new department of the government to manage a program like this?
I think we already know how to do all of the pieces of this. We're not talking about a giant infrastructure, because, you know, there are people who talk about how perfect the free market is, and that if the government just went away, everything would be great. And I would challenge those people to spend time in some of the villages I've spent time with around the world, where there essentially is no government. Mm-hmm. That in places like that, taxes are essentially zero, and you wouldn't want to live there. And in fact, the people who do live there tend to move away when they have a choice, because the government does an enormous number of things that are invisible. Infrastructure is invisible. Like, you buy a car, but you don't buy the roads. The roads come for, quote, free. And this infrastructure that we're talking about, that we all depend on, the one that you and I are talking over right this minute, has been built and maintained by communities. And one form of that community is the government. What I'm talking about is, in many countries around the world, there's already a system in place of things like classification. So we know the difference between buying an orange and buying a gallon of gasoline. That in the state where I live, there's already something in place that charges a tax on a gallon of gasoline. That none of these things have to be invented. What we need to do is simply add a dial to it. And that dial says, look, every single time we collect a dollar by charging the right price for carbon, we're going to distribute that dollar to every citizen. The end. And if you want more dollars, then spend less on carbon. If you spend more on carbon, you'll be putting dollars into the system, which we will give to other people. That simple transaction, and then when you add a border adjustment, means that if any major country starts doing it, every country around the world, its factories will have to pay attention to it, because it's going to cost them more to ship things to that country. The ratchet starts turning in the other direction. And we live in a culture where it is expected that price is a signal. And what I'm describing as a marketer is simple. Let's make the signal accurate.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned marketing. Your background is marketing. You've written 20 plus books. I have 3 young daughters, and we have this conversation probably more frequently than they like to, specifically around issues around consumerism and fast fashion and the Sheins and Temus and even the Amazons of the world. From what I see, 70 to 80% of all marketing is telling people or trying to push people to purchase things they don't really need. What can marketers do to enable us to move along this transition?
Well, so this is a juicy question. And I would start by saying your daughters are lucky to have you. But the thing is, all we need is food, water, shelter, and healthcare. Everything else is optional. And so if you're in the business of offering clean water to people out of the tap at commodity pricing, you don't need a marketer, because filling needs is different than creating, indulging, amplifying, connecting wants. And the entire world we live in is about that cycle forward. And we pretty much have to make one of two choices. Either we're going to shame people into voluntarily buying less, which A, doesn't really work, and B, when people make those choices, they almost always do them wrong. That when we showed up to do this project together around the world in 40 countries, we didn't meet face to face, but we had an online community where we built this book. People all showed up and said, including me, oh, I'm doing all the right things. If everyone would just do what I'm doing, everything would be fine. But the things people do, like composting, it doesn't matter. It's not going to make a difference at all. That mindful consumerism is not going to make a dent in solving this problem. That when we look at the impact of fast fashion, which is astonishingly horrible, 8% of the challenge of climate change comes from clothing. It's absurd that people buy 5 outfits, throw 4 of them out after wearing them once. But that by itself, holding back and only buying 2 outfits instead of 5 outfits, it's just not going to add up. And so we got tricked by the carbon footprint thing into thinking that this is our personal cost to bear. So let's talk about carbon footprint for a second. Most people don't know that carbon footprint, one of the greatest, most effective marketing slogans of my lifetime, was invented by Ogilvy & Mather, the ad agency, and their client was British Petroleum. And the reason British Petroleum wanted to invent and promulgate the idea of carbon footprint is to make people like you and me feel guilty. Because if we feel guilty, then we feel like hypocrites. And if we're hypocrites, we won't talk about it. And carbon footprint, the concept is fine. But when we look at the systems in place, one coal-fired plant undoes an enormous amount of interpersonal shaming among yoga moms. They cannot be compared. What we need to do is activate people like your kids to do community action. That one person not using a leaf blower is fine. But when that one person organizes 30 people and bans gas-powered leaf blowers, that is when change starts.
So earlier you said you're an educator. I mentioned my children. I ask them frequently. I have 2 in middle school, 1 in high school. How often do you hear about climate change or, you know, 1.5 degrees and what's going on with the earth? And repeatedly, they come back to me and said, we rarely hear about it. You know, you talk about it all the time. You have the podcast, mm-hmm. et cetera, but we don't hear about it. How do we take your message, your community's message, the carbon almanac, and get it into the school system so the children start learning about it?
So it's interesting that in Western culture, people almost never talk about death. Last time I checked, it was inevitable. It's something that we're going to have to deal with, whether it's just financially or emotionally. But we don't talk about it. We don't talk about it at school. We don't talk about it at home. And the reason is because we've been pushed to feel bad about it, and we know we can't do anything about it. And that is what's happening here, is that people think there's nothing they can do about it, and they've been pushed to feel guilty and shamed about it. So it's not surprising that it's not talked about a lot. And then add to it the idea that some people have politicized it. Now, it's worth noting that we knew about the math and the facts of climate change more than 100 years ago, and the papers have held up really well. That in the almanac, we reprint Exxon's memo from 1982, which describes to a tenth of degree what's going to happen to the climate, and it was right. So this isn't a political issue, but some people made it a political issue, so we wouldn't talk about it. And it feels to me like STEM is one way in, because teaching people to understand graphs and numbers and probabilities is useful no matter what they do. And so it becomes a fascinating case study. But the second thing, the thing that I think is the most important, is teaching it in school isn't nearly as important as teaching it. And what we need to teach at home is community organizing. We got seduced starting probably in 1925 to say, let somebody else take care of it. My job is to go to the factory, do my job, come home, watch TV, and go to sleep. But community organizing, everything that has gotten better in our culture has happened because of either technological innovation or community organizing, and they balance each other. When the community says, no, we're not going to let people drive 40 miles an hour in a school zone, that's not something that, you know, the Corvette people think is a good idea or a bad idea. It's what parents want, because you just can't drive 40 miles an hour in a school zone because I don't want my four-year-old getting hit. And this is about school zone legislation. This is about how do we come together as a community and say, nah, we're not going to let that happen. And teaching a seven-year-old about that, and a 12-year-old about that, that happens at home, at least in our culture.
You know, it's interesting where I'm seeing change in my peer group, or not even change, questions and concerns. So I'm here in the Dallas area. Homeowners insurance rates have gone up between 20 and 40%. And I've been trying to explain to friends of mine that a lot of it has to do with the wildfires and the floodings, tornadoes, hurricanes, et cetera, that are happening on the coast. And then obviously the insurance companies have to spread their risk. But from a top-down perspective, I'm seeing more and more curiosity, having more conversations specifically around people looking at the broader issues around climate because it's beginning to take a toll on their income or pocketbooks.
Yeah. I mean, what we learn from Donella Meadows and so many other systems thinkers is simple. Systems work better when the feedback loops are tighter. That if you can drive a vehicle with a feel for the road, it goes much better than if you have to take your shot and then watch what happens afterward. How do you make it so that the feedback loop gets shorter and more accurate? And what folks like you and I are saying is, look, this is the way the world is, not what we want it to be, but what it is. Let's make the feedback loops tighter. Let's bring the future to today. Because if we wait till we get to the future, it will be too late to do anything about it. But here we have this useful piece of feedback. And in the same way, if you see it sunny out, you should wear sunscreen. You're not going to get melanoma for a really long time, but you should wear sunscreen now because that brings the future to today when you can do something about it.
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't considered this as a feedback loop, but the congestion pricing that is in London, and I think didn't New York just implement congestion pricing also?
Any minute, it's gotten through all the hurdles.
It's going to be an interesting surprise to see how people respond to that.
Oh, I don't think it's going to be a surprise at all. I think it's going to be anticlimactic. What's going to happen is elites who can easily afford it won't change their behavior. And people who need to do it for a living will either need to get paid to make up for it or will find alternatives. So there will be some significant dislocation for some folks. But the net outcome of it is it will transform how people choose to get around when they have a choice. And inevitably, and the government's pretty good at this, the outliers will be given relief. And the net of it is that the idea of a walkable, livable city will be saved because we're charging the right price for it. It should not be free to drive to New York City midtown during rush hour. There's no reason that should be free. It is a public good that is scarce and we need to allocate it.
Now, I'm going to switch gears here, go back to the almanac. You mentioned your aha moment, if you will, after reading Ministry of the Future. You had this team, this community come together to put the almanac. What were some of the surprises or aha moments you had as this information was being put together? What are one, two, three examples that you can point to and said, I had no idea?
Well, the biggest delightful surprise was how talented people who didn't have credentials were at assembling data, working with each other to surface interesting pieces about it and hold it up for inspection to others without ego. That was the culture that I worked really hard to build, and it far exceeded my expectations. That was the first. The second one, in terms of the statistics, was the one I mentioned about beef, the idea that plastic cannot be recycled, and the way that we were able to describe to people what 400 parts per million means, because folks did not understand that. Even folks on the team did not understand that until we came up with a very simple image, which is in the book, but I can do it, a version of it, verbally, which is if you're a football fan, a football field is 100 yards long. The amount of carbon that was in the air when you were born was less than an inch of that 300 feet, less than an inch. And if it goes to 2 inches, the world as we know it will be over. That's it. That's how little carbon we're talking about. And all of a sudden, you understand that this invisible thing, because you think it should look like charcoal, like briquettes, this invisible thing is invisible because there's almost none of it. And that is why the planet is so sensitive, because we're taking something of which there is almost none and percentage-wise adding an enormous amount to it.
Were there any technologies that really piqued your interest?
I have been a science fiction fan since I was six. I worked with Isaac Asimov, one of the last projects of his life and one of the first of mine. And I've been in love with fusion power from the beginning. Fusion power has always been 40 years away. And it might still be 40 years away. It's been 40 years away my whole life. Fusion power changes everything. But there are things that are present right this minute that are systems disruptors. Everything from drip irrigation, which turns previously arid places into places that not only produce food, but can change the ecosystem. New battery technologies that will charge significantly faster and last much longer. The extraordinary decrease in price of wind and solar. If we had the wind and solar we have now, the technology, in 1920, we never would have built the ecosystem that we have now that's based on fossil. Solar, it is cheaper to build a solar plant than to build a coal plant. And you have to have a really good reason, and I don't think there are any, to build a new coal plant because solar is approaching free.
Have you seen any community issues or pushbacks in your area regarding solar and wind?
Oh, well, there's pushback to everything that's new. When any new technology shows up, whether it's a different kind of snack chip or a smartphone, it's going to change things. And being against change is inherent to every creature on Earth. Evolution doesn't like it when the ecosystem changes because it makes the species, puts the species at risk. We are averse to change. And so are there valid things that you can say like, wait, what if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and everyone wants electricity all at once? What are we going to do? You're exactly right. That's going to be a challenge we're going to have to overcome in interesting ways, the way we've overcome all other challenges before this. But if you look at New York City, where I live 15 miles away, if we had sat down in 1700 and said, these are all the things we're going to need to build to make New York City work, we're going to have to pump water from 18 miles away in the Catskills and build an aqueduct system that's underground, and we're going to have sewage, and we're going to have this and this, you'd say, never mind, we can't build New York City. But we did, because it's this incremental process of building a system. And what we are seeing with things like solar is that they are system changers. They're not just, let's replace a coal plant with a solar plant. What they are is, what happens when we get rid of the grid for 90% of our usage? What happens if every single person in Dallas has their own power plant? Well, that changes an enormous number of things in our ecosystem, and most of those are good shifts.
So you kind of reflect back on the past. I'm going to push it forward. Let's say it's 2033, and people are looking back over the last 10 years. If they were to write a headline about the Carbon Almanac, what would you like that to read?
I'm imagining that a generation is coming along, and we hear from these people all the time, who basically are saying, this thing that was invisible is now obvious to me. And it's only when something is obvious that community action is much more likely to happen. So in my little town, watching the progress about doing something so easy to defend, which is no more gas-powered leaf blowers. There's just no reason for them to exist. That an hour with a gas-powered leaf blower creates as much carbon impact as driving a Ford pickup truck from New York to Los Angeles. And their replacements, super handy, almost the same. Nobody is going to be harmed. But the status quo doesn't like it when things change. But what happens is people, not just the Almanac, but they read Paul Hawkins' work and lots of other things. They say, oh, this is obvious. And then change happens. So that's the business that you're in, that I'm in, to turn something invisible and to make it obvious.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the gas power leaf blowers, because I was serving at the city of Dallas for a few years and it came up over and over again. And yes, the carbon issues, but the hearing issues that the people that are using the blowers, it's migrants, it's people, you know, at the lower ends of the rung. Yep. And people talk about, my father was using a leaf blower for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, and now he's lost his hearing totally. Had no idea. And now Dallas is transitioning to all electric powered leaf blowers.
And, you know, it's interesting. The people who are opposed are not bad people, but you can just hear the status quo in their voice, because they'll give you 20 reasons why it's impossible. And then they switch and they're saying, whoa, I'm glad I did. But the list of reasons why change is impossible are easy to come up with. And what we need to do is keep bringing the future, the feedback loop, to the present. And no, it is no transition is effortless and perfect. If it was, we would have done it already. What we're saying is the cost of making a shift now is so small compared to the cost of dealing with not shifting later that we need to make this urgent. And you know, the last part of that riff is, when I was 3 years old, they started speaking publicly about the fact that cigarettes cause cancer. Not that they might, not that we have a hunch, but that cigarettes cause cancer. And yet, cigarette usage did not drop precipitously until one thing happened. And it's simple. They raised the tax on cigarettes. And that is what made people change their minds. But we had to go through all the other stuff first to make it obvious that this was a public health problem. And then we could do the thing that works the best.
Well, last question, and you've mentioned community many times during this conversation, is that if you could share some tactical advice for recommendations for the audience, what would it be?
We need to start with the smallest possible change. The smallest group you can imagine making the smallest possible change. So tactically, if you can get 5 people, just 5 in your town, to start working with the local school, you can make it so that Mondays they won't serve meat in the cafeteria. That's all it's going to take. 5 people showing up, showing up, showing up. One day a week, there's no meat in the cafeteria. And then you'll get to 10 people. And then you'll get to a second day. And we can cycle and we can cycle. And what people tell me over and over again is that the communities that they are part of that are taking action are now the most important part of their life. It makes them feel alive. It makes them feel like they're part of something. It makes them feel like they're leaving a legacy. We cannot do this by simply lowering our own carbon footprint. The only way to do this is to organize and talk about it.
Seth, I really appreciate your time today. For those of you listening, take the smallest step possible. And Seth, I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Well, thank you for doing this work. There are lots of free things at thecarbonalmanac.org, including a photo book with covers by Shepard Fairey, a kid's book that has been downloaded hundreds of thousands of times around the world, and the Spanish edition available for free.
Excellent. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review on iTunes. And you can show your support by sharing our show with a friend or reach out to us on social media, where you'll find us under our Nexus PMG handle. If there's a subject or topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email, btu@nexuspmg.com, or contact me via our website, nexuspmg.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, where we share what we're reading and thinking about in the clean tech, green tech sectors. Bigger Than Us is a Nexus PMG production.